Good morning to everyone.
Good morning.
What a beautiful church you have. It is my first time here, and I want to thank you for your hospitality and for Treva's hospitality, inviting me and Kent and the choir, which is fabulous. Such beautiful music this morning. I bring you greetings from Star King School for the Ministry, our Unitarian Universalist and multi-religious seminary in Berkeley, California, where I have the honor to serve as president. And I want to begin with a story that some of you may know and that some of you might have read from my memoir, Unafraid of the Dark. And it's about meeting the late conservative activist Phyllis Schlafly. I was a senior at Yale, and she had come to a debate at the Yale Political Union to debate Karen DeCrow, who at the time was president of the National Organization for Women, and the debate was on the Equal Rights Amendment. That's how old I am. Now, I knew a couple of the organizers of the debate, and they asked if I wanted to have dinner with them. And of course, I said yes, because I'm nosy. So we're having dinner in one of the private rooms in one of Yale's dining halls. And whoever organized the seating thought it would be a good idea to seat me directly across from Phyllis Schlafly. She was wearing pink, that cute pink that you associate with girls of another era. And she had perfect white hair. I, on the other hand, was being me, and being friendly in this deliberate way that you're friendly to someone when you don't particularly agree with them or like them, but you're trying to act like you have home training. I'm nothing if not my mom's child, so I knew that my mother would expect me to behave myself, so I was working on that. So Phyllis Schlafly asked me how I had come to be there. And I talked about being from Chicago and winning a scholarship to Yale and how I wanted to be a writer. And she looked at me with this very tight smile and a perfectly made-up face. And though I am paraphrasing, she basically asked me why I thought it was right to be going to Yale on a scholarship and why she and other people should have to pay for me to go to school. I can't remember what I said from that day to this day because I was so stunned to be asked that question. I remember my friend saying that I had been gracious, and I think that was because I was just dumbfounded. And for a long time afterwards, whenever I would think about that encounter, I just thought she was a mean and crabby and ungenerous person. I figured she was racist too. But it was the 1970s, and liberal people were going to place people like her to the side and move on to greater and greater progress, onward and upward forever. But that's not what happened, is it? Even though we have had fits and starts and movement toward the beloved community, what we find ourselves in the throes of now is the ascendancy of a white supremacist government that may actually be under the control of a foreign power. Our faith has been institutionally challenged as well. The anti-racism conversations that here and there have addressed the inhospitality of Unitarian Universalism for people of color has lately been broken open. They've been transformed by the work of Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism and a reinvigorated DRUM, which is Diverse Revolutionary UU Multicultural Ministries. The challenge has been so intense that the only question remaining is whether our faith will resist as much as our country has resisted the reality of white supremacy. There's a book that I can't recommend enough to help frame the common conversations about what is happening in our country and in our faith. There are a lot of really great books out there. I imagine you're all working on some version of this and reading some things. But this particular book is called White Rage, the unspoken truths of our racial divide. It's written by a woman named Carol Anderson. And here's what she says in her introduction. And it reminds us of where we are. The trigger for white rage, she says, is black advancement. It is not the mere presence of black people that is the problem. Rather, it is blackness with ambition, with drive, with purpose, with aspirations, and with demands for full and equal citizenship. It is while blackness that refuses to accept subjugation or to give up. A formidable array of policy assaults and legal contortions has consistently punished black resistance, resilience, and resolve. This book articulates a range of experience that is familiar to too many people of color and demands a response from every person who loves freedom. Because there is a through line between my dinner conversation with Phyllis Schlafly those many years ago, her contempt for a poor young black adult who found a way out of the circumstances of her birth, and the disruptions in our nation in the wake of our first black president, and the backlash from that, and the idea that black people might be approaching genuine equality. There's a through line between the disruptions in our faith in wake of leaders of color and the demands for change in Unitarian Universalist culture. That is the through line of white supremacy and white supremacy culture. White supremacy does not give up without a fight. It is resilient. It is persistent. It mutates like a virus. It co-opts. It seduces. It will not just let you walk away. So you have reason to worry if you are serious about justice. But if you are serious about justice, serious about our faith, serious about its power to change lives and save lives and bring meaning to our lives, you cannot quit because you are desperately needed. And make no mistake, white supremacist culture will work to destroy what it cannot control. I'll say that again. White supremacist culture will work to destroy what it cannot control. The white supremacist government under which we currently live would rather make common cause with the government of Russia, an ethnostate that enshrines whiteness, by the way, right, and is a focus of the worldwide white supremacist movement. They would rather make common cause with them than see the fulfillment of our common dreams of a beloved community in which people of color are full participants in American life.
No doubt.
We have a government that would rather commit human rights violations, separating babies from their parents and deliberately making it possible to reconnect those families, deliberately making it impossible, and then lying to us about how many there are, then understand the true nature of the Central American crisis that causes these refugees to flee in the first place. It's hard to face how naive I felt after thinking about the Phyllis Schlafly conversation, not understanding that her contempt of me was not really personal, but systemic, not a bug of conservative Christian-focused nationalism, but a feature. Not a bug, but a feature. For those of us who are progressive religious people, our naivete is even more baked in and thus more dangerous. Dangerous for us and for the ideals that we hold. Say what you will about religious people on the conservative end of the spectrum, their faith gives them clarity about the fallen nature of humanity, in their view. They see everyone as sinful, with a nature that guarantees their sinfulness unless and until they are saved. And once they are saved, yet and still they are forgiven no matter how many times they sin? Could it be that that's why they keep sinning? We in the Unitarian Universalist faith believe in the inherent worth and dignity of every person, already good, already saved. But if our conservative siblings struggle with the idea of goodness, it is we who are poorly equipped to deal with the reality of evil, with the reality and the capacity of evil people to project their own warped perspectives onto others, particularly others who do not look like or sound like or love like they do. Most of us would find it impossible to understand why people would put babies in cages. I don't understand. But when you step back for a moment, when you remember that evangelical Christianity carries within it a stream of contempt for poverty, viewing it as a sign of God's disfavor, a contempt that allows them to forget the many scriptural passages that command followers of Jesus to feed the hungry, clothe the naked, protect and shelter the orphan. It becomes easier to understand, but not easier to accept their actions. When you remember that some of these people believe that they are ordained by God to lead, in fact, to rule, and that they regard their efforts to erode democratic processes and norms as God-ordained, it becomes easier to understand, but not easier to accept. It also means that we of the open minds and hearts are at a distinct disadvantage. And if we did not learn this from the activities of the Mike Pences and the Betsy DeVoses of this world, if we have not seen this, we are already late in learning it. The future depends, the future we want anyway, depends on our learning things we would prefer not to know. We need to learn to take evil seriously. We need to take seriously that some people do not believe in the worth and dignity of any people and are willing to do terrible things to protect that worldview. We need to understand that those who would take children from their parents, who would take the right to vote away from United States citizens, who would take dignity from people who are fleeing persecution, have no interest in an open-hearted and reason-based appeal. They don't. And in most cases, they know. They never will. They will not. And we can make every faithful appeal that we know, but those appeals will most likely be in vain. Even when they do respond, they will slow walk and obfuscate and lie without remorse. We need to face that. What are we to do? We have to get tough-minded about evil whenever it appears. And we have to prepare ourselves spiritually for holding our own government, its citizens, even our neighbors, accountable for the monstrous harm that some of us are doing, even as I speak. It will take a generation to repair the harm that is being done right now. At least a generation. And it will require moral courage from all of us. There are people in our government right now who more than likely will need to go to jail. Some for financial crimes, perhaps even for treason. If the evidence should prove persuasive in a court of law, what are you willing to do to make sure jail is where they go? There are people in our government right now who almost certainly need to stand before the International Criminal Court to answer for the outrageous crimes being perpetrated on children. Who is going to insist on that? There are people who run for elections, and those elections are stolen. How will we help restore our democracy? What are you willing to do about that? Just like this country with its fragile democracy, there is within this living tradition of ours a belief in the best of humanity, as well as a radical openness to the divine. And it's a belief that has to remain part of everything we do if we are to be faithful. But we must also couple it with a kind of accountability that we've never had to use before. That accountability has to apply not just to our governmental structures, but to the structures of our faith tradition as well. We have to be prepared to struggle and fight for the world we want to live in. We can't sit back anymore. Genuine ministry, informed by the Spirit, is the most important tool we have to stand against this world that is determined to ruin us, to dehumanize us, and to pit us one against the other. We need ministers and congregations who covenant to fight this threat to humanity itself.
Yes.
We know in our hearts that something precious about life is being lost every day. We know that. So we need ministers and ministries, because we need to live as an example to others that there is something else, another kind of life to which we can aspire, a window into a different world in which we are more than the places we live and the jobs we have and the things we buy.
Amen.
We're also more than the places we can't live or the jobs we don't have or the things we can't afford. We are more than that, and life is more than those things. We have good news. We have good news to bring to those weighed down by the burdens of life, the misery of poverty, the plagues of sexism and classism and homophobia and transphobia, all byproducts of the insidious white supremacist culture that holds each of us in its grip. We know and can say with confidence that the Holy has other plans for each one of us. Each one of us, plans that include freedom and fullness of life, because we are working each day to live those things out. We have lived with all kinds of issues, but we have seen firsthand in our communities that what is broken can be healed. What is held captive can be set free. This is the faith we have. And though we are living it out under pressure, it is still worth all of our time, all of our energy, the best that we have to give, because these values are what help us shape our own lives and give birth to a world and a future worth having. Join with me in this. Amen.